Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and we need to remind you, I guess, in our appeal to heaven, the three things that, you know, create, I just think, better communication in all things, especially in our appeals to heaven. Learn, pray, act. Obviously, praying is that communication, but sometimes when we don't act, sometimes we don't realize that, you know, we really need to do something different. And as a matter of fact, I'm not sure, Tammy, but have you ever thought you needed something, and then when you went in and, you know, and you went out to go do it, and you realize that's not what I need. I actually need something different. So, anyway.
Yeah, probably more often than not.
Right. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to, because we're going to wrap up on the North Carolina debates, and there's always one other obligatory. It is all about constitutional compliance. And, folks, as we wrap up the ratification debates to the Constitution, this is literally how they justified, how they stipulated what these clauses mean. Now, what we're going to go into is it's kind of like somebody had a great idea. It's kind of like a platform. Have you ever been involved in a platform committee? Ever?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
And so there's a whole bunch of people, usually, you know, maybe sometimes it's the whole county, all the PCOs and everybody. And they just kind of said, well, let's work on a platform. Let's fix our platform. And so you get everybody mm-hmm. there, and it seems like everybody's got an idea. Whether it's, you know, redundant or whether it's the same thing, but they want to add this line. Have you ever seen that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how often have you ever seen a platform actually written by a person just actually said, boom, here, you write it all out, and this is our platform. What do you think about that? And everybody goes, wow, that's great. Because
yeah, no, never.
That's right. It's never that way because everybody wants to have their mark on it. Well, you see that right there? I thought that was important. That's mine. And and so it's more of a social, what's a good way of saying it? Where it's a feel-good social moment where everybody kind of comes together and they get their little say in what they believe in for the party.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody has ever thought, at least to this point, I've never seen anybody suggest that, hey, let's get rid of all this stuff and let's just focus on the Constitution. None of this has anything to do with the Constitution. 9 times out of 10, most all the stuff has nothing to do with the Constitution. As a matter of fact, almost everything that they throw in there should be, you know, this is not for government to do, right? Abortion, stopping abortion, mm-hmm. and protecting life, that's something the government's not supposed to be doing. Not just protecting life, but being involved in life at all. Determining those, the federal government should be doing that. So technically, and actually, I've made suggestions before to parties, at national and state level and even county level, that technically you should have two platforms. Do you know why? And I would even throw in a third platform. Do you need a platform for each of your constitutions? So in other words, you need to address the federal constitution saying, and basically the platform would be this simple. If it is not enumerated, they can't meddle with it. Something like that. I mean, it doesn't need to be, when we read these mission statements, corporate mission statements, this is what we're all about. They're usually very well written and, you know, succinct and, you know, I don't want to say comprehensive, but, you know, they're not long. They're not a whole bunch of pages. A mission statement is a good, you know, maybe a good paragraph, quarter page, half page, maybe at most, because that's what they're all about. This is what they're all about. And so a platform really should kind of be that, to say, this is what we demand out of the federal government. This is what we're all about in, you know, creating and driving our politicians into the federal government. We want them to obtain full compliance with the Constitution. Now, is that a bad thing?
Yeah, no, definitely not.
Okay, so when we really look at the platforms today, and we look at those youngsters that might be decent people to, you know, get involved in the party, and they look at that platform, do you think it speaks to them? And if it does, then I'm kind of concerned, because it's, you know, it's almost like we're bringing, in some ways, we're bringing church, family, and all sorts of things into the party. And as near as I can tell, the party is the medium in getting government either to do bad things or do what they're supposed to do. Really can't have it either way, right? To violate the Constitution or comply to the Constitution. And both parties, all parties, even libertarians and Constitutional Party, all of them are, you know, trying to push issues, and they're taking positions that have nothing to do with compliance with the Constitution. Technically, they're not seeking compliance. They're seeking an agenda. My point is this, is that if you've been involved in the parties, and if you kind of look at the constitutional ratification debates, this is where, and they don't show you the names, though, do they? They don't show you who suggested this, who suggested. What they did was they probably created a forum or a subcommittee, and everybody that went on that subcommittee, they all kind of went around and got turns to, you know, add their lines to it, and then this is what they presented. And then 9 times out of 10, it goes around. There's always a few people in the crowd that go, well, we need this. So anyway, and so as we look at this, and folks, where we are is we're on page 166 of the North Carolina ratification debates. And these are the Declaration of Rights, like Tammy said. And it's kind of funny. For formatting purposes, it has both a bullet and then a number. And that comes down to the fact that we wanted to make sure that we created the citations. For some reason, they had the quotations. I didn't really play with that. I just basically kind of left that alone. And so these, they don't tell you who's saying these things. I have no idea why there's a leading quote, but obviously, it's like amendments, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Third, Fourth, and Fifth, and so forth. So this is their feel-good moment, where everybody gets a chance to contribute and then walk away and say, well, I think I can, if this happens, I could feel good about this. So anyway, why don't you go ahead and we'll try to hit these. And I don't know. If we don't get through all of these today, that's okay. None of this has anything to do with defining the Constitution. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
All this is kind of an encapsulation of the things that they would like to see in the Constitution. It's a wish list. So go ahead. Let's start off with number one.
Okay. There are certain natural rights of which men, when they form a social compact, cannot deprive or divest their posterity, among which are the enjoyment of life and liberty, with the means of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety.
Okay, so now...
Just want me to keep going now on the list?
No. So if you look at that, that's a really good general statement. It's a great general statement. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what it has to do with, you know, the Constitution, the ratifying, but you got to remember, one of the things that came out of the constitutional debates was hardly any states had declarations of rights. And they go, you know what, maybe we need to do this. And so that's what we see in, you know, And what's forming really here is there for the first time, because they didn't have a Declaration of Rights prior to the Constitution and the ratification debates. Virginia was one of the very few ones that actually had, and they went through them thoroughly because of George Mason. So anyway, let's dive into the second one. And just go ahead and pause. I mean, if there's something you want to say or, okay.
Okay.
All right.
Bell power is naturally vested in and consequently derived from the people, that magistrates, therefore, are their trustees and agents, and at all times amenable to them.
Interesting they use the word magistrate, because the Constitution decimates the magistrate. Who is the magistrate? Is it the legislative? Is it the judges? Well, the judges can't be the magistrates because they can't make law. If you look at the British system, the king was the superior magistrate. And then he had magistrates underneath him he empowered to make law. In England, he empowered at first the judges to make law. And then later on, when the lesser magistrate was literally created much later, that's when the sheriff came in. And the sheriff was considered somebody that could actually, create law, collect taxes. Because the judiciary was, the nice thing about pomp and circumstance is as time goes on, people elevate themselves. I'm too good to do this. So judges, really, most judges just didn't get down into the knickers. So the top branch of the, I'll just say the judiciary in England, was really more of a centralized, not like the, help me out here, not like the Supreme Court, because we already heard it in the ratification debates that there were, one chief judge over this discipline, one chief judge over this discipline of, of law, and so forth. And so they kind of had their own little realms, and then they had their underlings. And so the underlings weren't trusted. So that's why the sheriff became the go-to guy for the king. And actually, the position of the sheriff was really more of a position of nobility, that, the person, it was an honor to be the sheriff, as well as, you were being recognized as a really good person. And so technically, the sheriff just basically collected taxes. He could make laws and say you can't do these things and kind of enforce the law, like stay out of the Sherwood Forest, that type of stuff. So, anywho, let's go with the third one now.
Okay. That government ought to be instituted for the common benefit, protection, and security of the people, and that the doctrine of non-resistance against arbitrary power and oppression is absurd, slavish, and destructive to the good and happiness of mankind.
Any comments? You good? Okay.
Nope.
Let's go with four.
Number four, that no man or set of men are entitled to exclusive or separate public emoluments or privileges from the community, but in consideration of public services, which not being descendable, neither ought the offices of magistrate, legislator, or judge, or any other public office to be hereditary.
Okay, so that's interesting, because they wanted to make sure, because that was the rule for centuries in England.
Yeah.
Okay. Because remember, the land barons were elevated into a royalty status, and they were no longer land barons. Then they created the counts.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's go ahead with the next one.
Okay. Number five, that the legislative, executive, and judiciary powers of government should be separate and distinct, and that the members of the two first may be restrained from oppression by feeling and participating the public burdens. They should, at fixed periods, be reduced to a private station, returning to the mass of the people, and the vacancies be supplied by certain regular elections, in which all or any part of the former members to be eligible or ineligible, as the rules of the Constitution of Government and the laws shall direct.
Interesting. So it looks to me like they just focused on the legislative and executive being restrained from oppression by feeling or participating in public burden, that type of thing. So, okay, next one.
number six, that elections of representatives in the legislature ought to be free and frequent, and all men having sufficient evidence of permanent common interest with an attachment to the community ought to have the right of suffrage, and no aid, charge, tax, or fee can be set, rated, or levied upon the people without their own consent or that of their representatives so elected, nor can they be bound by any law to which they have not in like manner assented for the public good.
So here's a question. Who pays for the primary?
We do.
Do the taxpayers pay for the primary?
Yeah.
So how did the party get away with this in every state? That we want to have our own little private elections. It's just for us. It's a primaries so that we can move our candidates forward. And
that's a good question.
Okay.
I've never thought about that. Yeah.
Okay. So, because right here he says that the elections of representatives in the legislature ought to be free and frequent. So people shouldn't even be paying for it. But it does come out of taxes. And so they wanted to make sure they kept the cost down. And the cheapest way of doing an election is by volunteers, precincts, and in-person voting. Tell me if I'm wrong. Buying computers,
absolutely.
Buying software, having all of these things designed, and, oh, we got to replace the hardware, we got all this networking. You know, it's not that difficult. It really isn't that difficult. Do it by, I mean, I remember we in the 60s and 70s, everything was hand-counted. Everything was hand-counted. Why? Why are we spending so much money, and actually they're creating these contracts, and who's getting them? Dell? These big, you know, corporations? And I'm going, they shouldn't even be involved. They're standardizing them. And actually, these are supposed to be done at the state level. Each state is to be autonomous, and technically, near as I can tell, I've yet to see any state constitution where the counties basically gave the state full cognizance to run all the elections. Technically, the elections are ran at the county. I mean, there are elections almost every year, and there are county issues, and those county issues are managed by the county. So, anyway, all right, seven.
Seven, that all power of suspending laws or the execution of laws by any authority without the consent of the representatives of the people in the legislature is injurious to their rights and ought not to be exercised.
Sounds like
an ex post facto law.
Yeah. I'd rather have them, because actually this is like suspending the writ of habeas corpus and that type of thing. It's almost like martial law. And I would like to actually see that they just, instead of not ought be practiced, but forbidden. Just one word, forbidden. It's forbidden. Can't do it. But anyway, eight.
That in all capital and criminal prosecutions, a man hath a right to demand the cause and nature of his accusation, to be confronted with the accusers and witnesses, to call for evidence, and to be allowed counsel in his favor, and a fair and speedy trial by an impartial jury of his vicinage, without whose unanimous consent he cannot be found guilty except in the government of the land and naval forces, nor can he be compelled to give evidence against himself.
So let me ask you this. How does this pan out with camera violations, like speeding tickets, you know, running reds, you know, that type of thing? When a person actually goes to court, do they have a right? Because that's actually a constitutional right. We have a right to face our accuser. And if the accuser is just hardware, how is that right? And as a matter of fact, there should be a person that actually says, okay, I'm going to pull this person over. When you actually make it so that everybody pays because they go a little bit over, boom, and we just start handing out tickets. How is that constitutional? See, we're to be securing our persons, our effects, papers, and everything from encumbrance of government. Now, we have this thing called common law, and our traffic system is under common law. And it's one thing to give us a citation that, you know, you're not being safe, and this is a warning. But they don't even do that. It is strictly a tax. It's a revenue mechanism, right?
100%, yeah. But,
okay, so in so doing, then it's not something that they can tax you. It's if they can catch you. In other words, they're out there looking, and how, if you're supposed to be secure in your persons and effects and property, and if that car's your property, then I don't see how they work this where they can actually be out there monitoring and collecting and going after people. Now, it's one thing if you're involved in an accident and to be cited because you're, mm-hmm. Unsafe driving based on the speed and everything else, you were an unsafe driver and you caused an accident. But if it's the conditions and everything else, and it can't be your fault because it was raining and you were driving, properly and so forth, but a cat went across the way or what have you, or a kid, circumstances, what? So there's the spirit of the law and there's the letter of the law. And an officer understands the difference. A camera doesn't. And a camera right. is literally an administrative function that says you violate, you violate, you violate, and just sends everybody tickets. There's all sorts of ways to start challenging this, but this is something that the people need to stand up and say, we don't want you to use law enforcement as a process of gaining revenue. You're already spending too much money as it is. That's one of the first taxes we need to reduce. It's one thing about crime, though. I mean, if you're drunk driving or because that is it's a moving violation, but it is very reckless. Crime and, stealing, those types of things, that opens up a different discussion. But in this particular case, I just think that how are our rights being protected in our current system? It just they're not connecting the dots. I mean, we're basically being taxed. Because if we behave badly, you get taxed. And it's not like yep. Anyway, I'll stop myself there. Let's go to 7.
9, actually, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, 9.
That yeah, no right. free man ought to be taken, imprisoned, or deceased of his freehold, liberties, privileges, or franchises, or outlawed, or exiled, or in any manner destroyed or deprived of his life, liberty, or property, but by the law of the land.
Okay, so these are obviously this is like the Bill of Rights, right? You can't be taken, mm-hmm. imprisoned, and your liberties. So, in other words, this is almost like a due process that you have. If you have these rights, then you should be able to, have a trial, but they don't even mention this here. But that's what they're talking about, that you can't be exiled, you can't be, thrown into jail or what have you, because, this is where you're depriving a person of life, liberty, or property. That's where they tied in due process. Okay, so the next one, every free man restrained. Okay. Go ahead.
To every free man restrained of his liberty is entitled to a remedy to inquire into the lawfulness thereof, and to remove the same if unlawful, and that such remedy ought not to be denied nor delayed.
Free man. So that's not a freeholder. That's a free man. In other words, you may not be a free. You know what a freeholder is, right? A freeholder is, I believe, a person that owns their property. They own it outright.
Oh, okay.
A freeman is a person that is not encumbered by a labor contract, a slave, indentured servant, or anything like that, and you have your own cognizance, you're in control of yourself, and we got to go into break. So let's go into break, and then when we come back, we'll kind of continue on. So, folks, I hope, just going through these things kind of helps, I think, cast this picture of how the states all addressed what they wanted to see in addition to the Constitution. And so they wanted these Declaration of Rights. So we'll be right back, and we'll probably, if we get a chance, we'll get into the amendments as well. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we're back, and actually, let's just jump down into the next section, the amendments, because they go from these declarations of rights into the amendments. And so we kind of see, because these actually are trying to fill the gap of what they feel necessary to secure what they believe they've been sold. In other words, they're buying into this compact. They're forming this general government, and this union is going to abide by the laws that are all in pursuant to those delegated powers. In other words, we're going to be governed in a very limited way, but we're going to be governed by this new form of government. And so these amendments are what they believe is really necessary to go, I'll just say, beyond how it was sold. Even though the Constitution was clearly sold that the government could not do anything that's not enumerated. All right? We heard that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's go ahead into the First Amendment.
Okay. That each state in the Union shall respectively retain every power, jurisdiction, and right which is not by this Constitution delegated to the Congress of the United States or to the departments of the federal government.
Okay, so it's almost like a waste of words on a piece of paper because they were constantly told. Now, the reason why they wanted to do this, they wanted to actually put words on paper, is because I don't believe at this point in time they had the maturity in contract law and how the ratification debates were being handled. I don't think they had the maturity because none of them basically went out of their way and says, just remember, this is how it was sold, right? In other words, mm-hmm. after the states ratified, they all kind of went their merry way because they did these good things and they got their Bill of Rights after the first session and, you know, they were just proud of themselves. But to be true, and to be very clear here, they failed to keep their eye on every stipulation of how each of those clauses in the Constitution were defined or clarified and stipulated. Why? Because that's how it was sold. And, oh, by the way, Madison was out doing just that, saying, hey, don't forget that this is how this was stipulated. We've read several documents where Madison comes back and says, hey, look, the Constitution was justified by these very limited enumerations. They couldn't do anything outside of them. So today, if you were going to create a compact, you were going to do this and do exactly what they did, would you just go through the ratification debates, let all these things be stipulated, and just bury it? As the party to the compact, understanding that there's this potential that this creature may try to assume power and basically subjugate you. It seems like that's where we are today. What would you do to ensure that that couldn't happen? as a state. I mean, everybody bought into it and everybody started behaving, but you know, down the road when the, you know, the word of mouth, as everybody says, well, they couldn't do this. You don't rely on the word of mouth. You have to teach everybody the ratification debates. You have to basically make sure everybody understands how the Constitution was stipulated. You do that, mm-hmm. then, and you make sure that the judges can't redefine or interpret anything. The only thing they can use are the ratification debates, and if there's a question, hey, there's a kind of a gap here. We understand this, this, and this, but there's this gap on this one little thing here, and we can't find a really good definition. What do we do? And that's the question. What would they do, or what should happen? If the judges can't come up with it, if they can't point to a definition, any clarity, they can't interpret. They actually have to turn to the parties, to the states, and say, hey, in this compact you created for us, how do you want us to deal with this? We're seeing this little void on what to do about that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So when the federal government creates a...
That would be ideal.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm just saying that would be... I mean, that makes sense. Go back to the people who made the contract.
Yeah, so today, when the government creates a contract and they get this subcontractor to go build a bunch of roads, and they go, you know, you had us build all of these roads, but, you know, you didn't tell us what material to use, you know, for this, that, or, you know, some things were missing. What did you want us to do? And that's, oh, by the way, going to affect the cost, because now we realize that there's material missing that we didn't bid for, that we find that we needed in the delivery to have the, like, lines in the road. We got to paint these lines. You know, we're just building roads, but you want us to paint lines too. And it wasn't clear, and it's only at the very end that, oh, well, we have these standards that you had to build for, and so, but it wasn't in the RFP or what have you. So regardless, the subcontractor, the creature that was created by that compact, goes back to the federal government and says, what do you want us to do? And I'm going to tell you, if it was clear enough in the contract that they needed to bid that, to do that, and it was assumed that it was bid by them basically providing their cost, if it's going to cost this much to do this, then if the government feels that they can actually say, well, you're going to have to pay for it and you're going to have to perform it. We don't care if you didn't manage or put that into your cost. You gave us a bid, and we accepted your bid for doing all the work that was baked into this whole thing. You digested it. You put all the work out. You've got the materials, cost, all these schedules, everything else, and you go, this is what it's going to cost. And so we accepted. We shook hands. You now were awarded this contract. You have to perform it. We don't care where you get the money, and but you better have those lines done when you turn this road or bridges and all these things over. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And that is because the government is very clear. When they're the superior party, when they're seeking subcontractors, because that's what the states did. The states didn't just create a group of people that, you know, for a time in eternity, all these women and men were going to have children, that their children would be destined to become representative judges. No, it wasn't that way at all. There was no deterrent. It was this whole thing put in motion that they were going to create these seats and so forth. The states have the full authority to determine how to define that. If it wasn't defined and the federal government comes along and says, hey, you guys didn't really define this, we're stuck. What do we do? They have to define it. Congress doesn't have the power. They don't have the power to create a definition that wasn't clear in doing something. Now, interestingly enough, when the Constitution was ratified and Congress went into session, they knew how to define everything. That's why the act of administering the oaths was done. And they clarified it, and the states didn't have any pushback. The only pushback that started coming, and actually it didn't even come from the states because the states weren't really aware. like the Assumption Act. I think some of the states probably would have been a little bit more vigorous in saying, hey, don't, you can't do this. But what Hamilton did was he made it a win for everybody. So the states would go, oh, well, yeah, you shouldn't do that, but hey, we win, so who cares? Does that make sense? And that's how Hamilton was getting the states to literally do nothing while he was assuming powers and putting things in motion that would put this put the nation on a wrong path. So going through this and going through this very first, because we're just right here in the very First Amendment, but the point is that they only can do those things and the way they've defined them, those things that are in the Constitution, actually enumerated, has to be derivative. In other words, another thing Hamilton did was he goes, well, we think it's implied. As a matter of fact, throughout the constitutional ratification debates, they shut down the arguments of implication. If it is not within the, expressly within the enumerated power, then they can't imply that they can do it. And it came out, it literally came out that the states had to hold them accountable. I mean, every time they talked about the federal government getting, you know, encroaching on things that they didn't have the authority to do, the states would sound the alarm and they would basically go and hold the government accountable, which is why in 1798, Madison and Jefferson did just that with Kentucky and Virginia. Okay, so let's move down to the next one. Go ahead. Because this is key, too.
Okay.
Go ahead.
That there be one representative for every 30,000 according to the enumeration or census mentioned in the Constitution, be continued or increased as Congress shall direct upon the principles fixed in the Constitution by apportioning the representatives of each state to some greater number of the people from time to time as the population increases.
Wow, do you see what they're talking about here? Giving Congress the ability to determine how many people they're going to represent. And the more people they represent, the less accountability they have. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, when you have a million people that are being represented by this one guy, how is it even possible that you're getting real representation?
Yeah.
Okay. So there was a reason why they went to 30,000. But the interesting thing is this amendment fell flat in the first session of Congress because this wasn't the first, you know, this wasn't the first amendment out of all the amendments that went in like this. Believe it or not, the states that did these later ratifications, you will find that many of them copied Pennsylvania and Massachusetts and the early states. Those were really good ideas. We should use those. So that's why there's a lot of similarity, and sometimes it's almost word for word. But when we look at this one right here, what actually came in the Bill of Rights as the amendment to the Constitution was a process that Madison created, a hard fixed progression that it would go from 30,000 to 40,000 when the count of representatives in the House reached 100. And it was standing at 100 representatives, then they would change the census and apportionment to based on the because they change on the census. So every 10 years when they do a census, that's when they change the apportionment. So the apportionment's locked for 10 years. And so if there's a need for change and they get to 100 representatives in the House of Representatives and they have the census and it's still, okay, we're at that point. We just had 100, and now we're well over 100. At that point, they would then shift to representing 40,000 people to bring the number back down, and it goes up until 40, to 200,000 or 200 representatives to 40,000. I'm sorry. So it's 100. Once you have 100 representatives, it goes to 40,000. And then once you have 200 representatives, it goes to 50,000. Does that make sense? So that's the very first amendment in the Bill of Rights that did not get, well, it got ratified, but it just never got accounted for by Connecticut. Connecticut actually has it documented that they ratified it, but they never turned it into the government, and it's still sitting there with the ratification being done, and it hasn't been turned into the federal government yet. And had they done that, that amendment would have been galvanized in the Constitution. And which means that it proves, and actually just the fact that that amendment exists, that you have to amend the Constitution to change that number from 30 to 40. You can't let Congress make that number up. It has to be an amendment by the states to say, we'll allow that. And see, the states are in charge. And even right here, they're making a huge mistake of saying, well, let Congress manage that. What? Are you kidding me? Anyway, let's go to the next one.
Okay. Number three, when Congress shall lay direct taxes or excises, they shall immediately inform the executive power of each state of the quota of such state according to the census herein directed, which is proposed to be thereby raised, and if the legislature of any state shall pass any law which shall be effectual for raising such quota at the time required by Congress, the taxes and excises laid by Congress shall not be collected in such state.
Okay, so, again, the squabbling of taxes, I don't want to deal too much with that. Let's go to the next one.
Okay. Okay. Number four, that the members of the Senate and House of Representatives shall be ineligible to and incapable of holding any civil office under the authority of the United States during the time for which they shall respectively be elected.
Okay, let's go to the next one. Unless you got a comment on that.
That the journals of the proceedings of the Senate and House of Representatives shall be published at least once in every year, except such parts thereof relating to treaties, alliances, or military operations, as in their judgment require secrecy.
Okay. Anything with that? Mm-mm. See, these are kind of just not really big things. Let's go ahead to the next one.
That a regular statement and account of receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published at least once in every year.
Okay.
Do they still do that?
Yeah. They actually produce the budget expenditures. They actually, when you look from what comes out of the Treasury and for the federal government, they provide a 10-year look ahead of what their tax needs are going to be. And they basically, for the current year, they show exactly what they spent in contrast to the year before. Because there's always these different funding mechanisms, like these boondoggles, unconstitutional boondoggles, like infrastructure bills, that actually increase the spending.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like the coronavirus. So when they start increasing spending, then that debt clock unconstitutionally changes up and up and up. The whole fact is, all the money that's spending on these things, they're not constitutional. It's all fraud. So
that's right. We don't have to pay it back.
That's correct. We technically do not have to pay that back, and actually, the states or nations that have purchased or basically offered us debt to spend on things we didn't have the authority to spend on, they're equally culpable. They should have known we didn't have the authority. These guys didn't have the authority to do it. And they said, we don't care because the plan is that you guys will get to a point where you can't service the debt, and then we can foreclose and take everything from you.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so let's keep going. What's the next one? Go ahead.
That no commercial treaty shall be ratified without the concurrence of 2/3 of the whole number of the members of the Senate, and no treaty ceding, contracting, restraining, or suspending the territorial rights or claims of the United States, or any of them, or any of their rights or claims of fishing in the American seas or navigating the American rivers shall be made, but in cases of the most urgent and extreme necessity, nor shall any such treaty be ratified without the concurrence of 3/4 of the whole number of the members of both houses, respectively.
So see, they want to actually start splitting the responsibilities between the people and the state governments. And when you kind of look at that very specific thing, who cares the most about those treaties affecting commerce? Well, you think the people, but really the people don't. It's the states. Because that could make or break a business. And most people wouldn't even know that. Or it could actually, you know, make a business. Most people wouldn't know that. So the people that would understand the ramifications of commerce treaties and so forth would be the state legislature. Period. I mean, when these guys went through this, as I look at some of these arguments, like, the members of the House, respectively, you know, being ineligible to hold any other office. I mean, that was dealt in the Constitutional Convention, and they made it that way so that you couldn't get emoluments from a state salary as well as a federal. One way or the other, you're either going to be a federal office, you're going to be in federal office or state office. You can't be in both. Anyway, and it's the same thing with this. So let's go to 8.
No navigation law or law regulating commerce shall be passed without the consent of 2/3 of the members present in both houses.
Okay. Now the no standing, because all of these things were really well covered in the Constitution. And I don't see these amendments really. So maybe these guys weren't copying verbatim, because most of these are just like germane. They're not that good, because they're not really identifying filling gaps. There's a couple, but they're not really filling gaps. Go ahead. Go to the next one, the standing army.
Number 9, that no standing army or regular troops shall be raised or kept up in time of peace without the consent of 2/3 of the members present in both houses.
Now, that's bringing the Senate as well as the House of Representatives involved again. And so, and bottom line, but they're creating a threshold. They want to have at least a supermajority. And so, it's one thing to make changes, but for them to be able to do the job that they need to do, we shouldn't be, I don't like the democracy side of it, but bottom line, they have very limited powers, and they have these powers for very specific reasons. And so when we have to tie their hands, they need, because what happens when all of a sudden, almost everything you do, you have to have a high consensus. In other words, this 2/3 rule. Well, then you have to go around and you have to start making compromises. And 9 times out of 10, compromises just waters down and basically dilutes the effect of what you're trying to do. Does that make sense? No? Okay.
I'm not sure.
So
you're saying that having the...
Yes. So if...
Say that
again. If I want to have a standing army, we want to fund a standing army, and I need you, a few people, to vote for it, then they may have a boondoggle that we will vote for, because this is how they actually start doing things, by compromising. Just make it 50%. Just get 50% and get it across the line. If it's something they've been empowered to do, the process, if we're not happy with something that they did, we'll either amend the Constitution or kick their butts out of office because they sent us to war.
Okay.
All right. And that's how it was really covered in the debates, too. I mean, the process, if you're not happy with how your servants are serving you, then you replace them. Anyway, go ahead. No soldier.
Number 10.
Yeah.
That no soldier shall be enlisted for any longer term than 4 years, except in time of war, and then for no longer term than the continuance of war.
And that's interesting, because back in those days, you know, we were looking at the Revolutionary War was a pretty significant war, because it went on for years, right? I mean, peace was in 1783, and that war kicked off in 1776. Technically, if I remember correctly, it kicked off in 1775. So it went 13 years. And they didn't do that for most of the army. I mean, many people got to go home, and they got other people to replace them, just because, I'm tired, or I'm not feeling good, or what have you. and to basically create indentured servants as your military, that's not good. That's not good at all. The bottom line is that it's one thing to keep the numbers up, but you need to rotate those people in and out.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Especially for war.
Unless they voluntarily want to stay in, but...
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, nine times out of ten, there are people that... You know, I've met people. I knew a guy going to war, and he said, you know, I'd rather go to war because he was going through a divorce and stay here and deal with my wife. So anyway, yeah, there's different motivators, right, of, you know, what sends people to war. But anyway, that willingly go into war. All right, go ahead, next one.
Number 11, that each state respectively should have the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining its own militia, whensoever Congress shall omit or neglect to provide for the same, that the militia shall not be subject to martial law except when in actual service in time of war, invasion, or rebellion, and when in the actual service of the United States, shall be subject only to such fines, penalties, and punishments as shall be directed or inflicted by the laws of its own state.
Okay, so what they're trying to do is they're trying to make it so that there's no uniform punishments, that there's, you know, each state, it creates a chaotic issue, creates a chaotic problem. But when you look at this whole thing, providing for organizing, arming, and disciplining, we talked about this several times. I'm surprised that nobody said that when the federal government fails to provide for the training and equipping, in other words, they fail to give you the money and equipment that you need to maintain your militia, then you do it and you basically offset that on the taxes they want to put on you. Remember, we talked about that. I believe that would have been an appropriate amendment to ensure that the federal government never misses their deliveries on delivering arms, training, and those types of things to keep a very well-regulated and invigorated militia. Now, I kind of talked about this yesterday with an East Coast meeting, that when we look at the militia and its job in this constitutional republic, the states should have actually started implementing the militia throughout all of its ranks. I mean, most of the states kind of did, but they didn't do it in a way so that they had a police system baked into the same thing. So that, in other words, everybody has to spend a little time serving in law enforcement and or security, whatever you want to call it, but everybody does it. And in so doing that, then you actually are... you're prepared for when, I'll just say, bad things start happening. And bad things started happening because every year for Christmas, I actually air a show. And in that show, I point out how New York, things got so bad, New York actually, we're out of time. New York actually had to create their own law enforcement, municipal law enforcement, because things were getting too wild, because the poor people, the drunk poor people, were picking on the rich people, taking their property and beating them up and so forth. And so they created a law force. Had they had the militia in place, they would have solved the problem just like that. And just like that, folks, we're out of time. This concludes the North Carolina debates. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.